The Sign of Moses' Rod.
For a topic for our discussion this morning, we thought we'd take up the subject of the sign of Moses' rod. You may recall this subject as being one of three signs discussed in the reprint article, The Voice of the Three Signs. When Moses was 40 years of age, Moses was in a position where he felt that God had called him to deliver Israel. And you recall how, as a result of his premature actions, his own people rejected him. And he was forced to flee into the wilderness, Sinai wilderness. There he married Zipporah, became very involved with Jethro the Midianite, who lived in that area, and spent 40 years tending sheep and herds in the Sinai. And then at the end of that 40 years, when Moses was 80 years of age, by now he realized that he was not in a position to save anybody, Israel, let alone himself. And so he felt that his life was to be a sheep herder. Then God said, now I can use you. And then Moses says, oh no, you can't. Now I can't be used. Now I realize that I have nothing. And that was the exact thing that God was looking for in the development of Moses' character. When the Lord convinced Moses at the burning bush that he was to be used, Moses made a stipulation. He said, I can't even talk good anymore. I need a spokesman. God arranged for his elder brother Aaron to be his spokesman. But Moses still had one more main thing that was holding him back. And he said, the people won't believe me. How can I convince them that now is the time for their deliverance? And that is when the Lord gave him these signs. Basically, our study will be in the fourth chapter of the book of Exodus. Exodus chapter 4. We're going to start by reading the first 9 verses. And we want to get an overview of all three signs before concentrating on the first of the three. Moses answered and said, behold, they will not believe me, nor hearken unto my voice. They will say, the Lord hath not appeared unto thee. And the Lord said unto him, what is that in thine hand? And he said, a rod. And he said, cast it on the ground. And he cast it on the ground, and it became a serpent. And Moses fled from before it. And the Lord said unto Moses, put forth thine hand, take it by the tail. He put forth his hand and caught it, and again it became a rod in his hand. That they may believe that the Lord God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, that the God of Jacob hath appeared unto me. And the Lord said furthermore unto him, put now thine hand into thy bosom. And he put his hand into his bosom. And when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous as snow. And he said, put thy hand into thy bosom again. And he put his hand into his bosom again, and he plucked it out of his bosom, and behold, it was turned again as his other flesh. It should come to pass, if they will not believe thee, neither hearken to the voice of the first sign, they will believe the voice of the latter sign. And it should come to pass, if they will not believe also these two signs, neither hearken unto thy voice, that thou shalt take of the water of the river, and pour it upon the dry land, and the water which thou takest out of the river shall become blood upon the dry land. First, we want to notice the purpose. The purpose of these three signs was to give Moses a tool to prove to others that he was God's representative and that he had full authority. All three signs had one thing in common. They were taking something which was helpful and useful and making it bad, making something harmful from it. And in two of the signs, there was the reclaiming back to the condition of usefulness. A rod into a snake into a rod. A hand into a leprous hand into a good hand. Pure water into blood. Not back into pure water, but pure water into blood. And then as we read the whole account, we notice it eventually goes back to pure water. Each of these have the same basic format. That which is good is permitted to deteriorate into that which is evil, but is reclaimed into that which is good. These signs that God gave to Moses were very effective. And they were used on three separate occasions. They were not just used once. They were used three times to three different people. Not every sign in all three occasions. In fact, only once do we find all three signs used. The reason they're used on three separate occasions is that Moses has to convince three separate individuals or groups of individuals that he has God's authority. He has to first convince Aaron. He has to second convince the elders of Israel. He has to third convince Pharaoh. With Aaron, he uses all three signs. With the elders of Israel, he uses signs 1 and 2 only. With Pharaoh, he uses signs 1 and 3 only. So there's a little distinction as we go through the usages of the signs. Now, obviously the reason they need to be convinced, we've already covered, is because of the earlier rejection of Moses by his own people and by the Hebrews, by the Egyptians as well, because he had killed one of their men and he was wanted as a murderer in the land of Egypt. Let's notice the usages of the signs. Going to the end of the fourth chapter, coming to verse 27 and 28, we find the first usage. And the Lord said to Aaron, "Go into the wilderness to meet Moses." And he went and met him in the mount of God and kissed him. And Moses told Aaron all the words of the Lord he had commanded him and all the signs which he had commanded him. So in the use by Moses to Aaron, he did not perform the signs. He merely related the signs. And he says all the signs which he had commanded, which implies that all three were told to Aaron. Then verses 29 to 31 gives us the second usage. And Moses and Aaron went and gathered together all the elders of the children of Israel. And Aaron spake all the words which the Lord had spoken unto Moses, and did the signs in the sight of the people. And the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord had visited the children of Israel, that he looked upon their affliction, then they bowed their heads and worshipped. Now notice the first phrase in verse 31. And the people believed. Now go back and notice what he says in verse 9. It shall come to pass if they will not believe these two signs, then turn the water into blood. So this is why we think that the third sign was not performed before the people of Israel. They did believe. They didn't need the third one. Someone might say, and very truthfully so, that in verse 29, I said earlier here that if they didn't believe, the second sign would be they didn't believe the first one. Yes, that's it, verse 8, thank you. It shall come to pass that they will not believe thee, neither hearken to the voice of the first sign, then they will believe the voice of the latter. So some may say, well, he must have only performed the first sign because they believed. But you notice in verse 30, it says, and did the signs, plural, in the sight of the people. So the implication is he did at least two of the signs in the sight of the people. So in the second use of the signs, he used, we think, the first two, but not the blood sign. Then going to the seventh chapter, and we'll get into this a little bit more just a little later, we find that he uses the sign of the serpent in the seventh chapter, verses 1 to 13. And you remember how Pharaoh's magicians duplicate the sign, but then Moses' serpent eats up their serpent before it becomes a rod again. And then immediately following that, verse 13, he hardened Pharaoh's heart that he hearkened not unto him, as the Lord had said. And the Lord said unto Moses, Pharaoh's heart is hardened, he refused to let the people go. Get thee unto Pharaoh in the morning, lo, he goeth to the water, and thou shalt stand by the river's brink against he come, was waiting for him. And the rod which was turned to a serpent shall thou take in thy hand, And thou shalt say, The Lord God of Hebrews has sent me unto thee, saying, Let my people go, that they may serve me in the wilderness. And hitherto thou wouldst not hear. Thus saith the Lord, In this thou shalt know that I am the Lord. Behold, I will smite with the rod that is in mine hand upon the waters which are in the river, and they shall be turned to blood, and the fish that are in the river shall die, and the river shall stink, and the Egyptians shall loathe to drink the water of the river. So to Pharaoh, he goes immediately from the sign of the rod, bypassing the sign of the leper's hand, to the sign of the blood, which becomes the first plague of the ten plagues. So there's only one sign preceding the ten plagues in the Exodus picture. What are the signs? Well, I think to see what the signs are in the reality is to first go and notice what is pictured in Moses' rejection and then acceptance later. As we see Moses willing to deliver his people, but turned back by them for a time, and then returning to his people and accomplishing deliverance, doesn't it remind us of Jesus? Christ came unto his own, and his own received him not. And so he was rejected by his people, and he went. And then when he returns to accomplish the deliverance that he was ready to do as far as his willingness at the first advent. So we have in here this basic picture of the deliverance by Moses of the children of Israel. Now, when Christ returns, he comes, as far as mankind is concerned, lacking authority. Again, when he returns, people do not recognize him as their king. And he needs to perform certain signs that demonstrate his authority to them. And it's these that are pictured in the signs of Moses. That which gives Christ the authority to accomplish the work at the second advent. When he comes, he uses the signs three times. Even as Moses first used it to Aaron, then to the elders of Israel, and then finally it is used to Pharaoh, people at large. It becomes public, the third use. So the Lord has his return. The first one, we think, is the use to the spokesman of the Lord. And here we feel that the spokesman of the Lord fits very well the particular servant that he chooses at the second advent, the wise and faithful servant, Pastor Russell. The second time he uses it to the elders of Israel. And we think this represents to the church class. The third time he uses it, it's used to Pharaoh. It's used in a very public manner. And we think this is when his authority becomes recognized by the world at large. So there are the three pourings out of these signs. What is it that makes Christ acceptable? What is it that shows his authority? We think there are three things that show Christ's authority to the church and eventually show it to mankind. And they're the three things we learn through that wise and faithful servant. So they're shown three times. Although we'll see why only certain ones are used each time. The first thing is the recognition that Christ has come to take control over his affairs. That's the first real important thing that mankind will recognize. And that's the first important thing we must recognize, is that his return is to take control over his affairs. And this is shown by a rod. That was his management of his job. That's what the shepherd's rod was. Shepherd was how he handled his office. You see a picture of a man clothed in a flowing robe. You've got no idea what he is, does it? You just know, oh, that's a man that must date back to Bible times. That's sort of the impression you get. You see that same man there with a staff in his hand, you say, oh, he's a shepherd. You don't see any sheep. You don't need to see that. That tells you what his work is. So here it's the work, the office. He says, well, throw it down, let it go. As soon as he relinquishes that office, what happens? Evil takes place. God permits evil on this earth. And it's out of control. The world's amok. It runs every way it wants to run. And they say, there is no way that order can be brought out of this chaos. But we with the eye of faith and mankind with the eye of sight eventually will see him stoop down, take it by his tail, and again, authority is there. The re-grasping of authority. The permission of evil and the fact that this permission of evil is not haphazard, but within a plan, is proof number one that Christ is Christ. That he is the one who is in control. The second proof that he uses is he has those doing work for him. He selected 144,000 plus many others who didn't make it to do his work for him, to be his representatives on the earth. But once he went away, when they were on the scene by themselves, behold, they were lepers. They were imperfect. The agencies that he used were imperfect agencies. And so as long as these agencies were imperfect, man could say, well, if that's Christ's kingdom, if those are his representatives, I can't see it. This isn't what I expect. But when he comes, what's the first thing he does executively? He raises the sleeping saints. He puts that which has gone back into his bosom, and it comes out clean. And it comes out perfect. He gives back perfection to that which had lost perfection, so that his hand can be in the affairs of the earth. It is the taking of an imperfect agency to do his work, the permitting it to be leprous during much of the period of time when it's working for him, but the cleansing of it in its reuse in his service. The third thing is he works through truth. That is the agency in which Christ is always working, God is always working. But he permits his truth, when poured out, to be viewed as blood. He permits his truth to become a curse upon the earth. But he also has the power to reverse that curse. And the truths that, when poured out, first appeared to be repulsive, eventually become redemptive. So the ability to let truth take on its impure appearance and repulsiveness to people, and then the purification of truth, is the third sign that will eventually bring the acceptance of Christ. Now, our concentration in this study, because each of the three signs is worthy of a study in itself, our concentration is going to be on the first sign, the sign of Moses' rod. We've stated what it is. Now we're going to look it over with a few proof texts. First, we want to establish the fact that the rod is authority. And I think the most familiar text to establish it, the one that would come quickest to our minds, is Psalm 23. Psalm 23, verse 4. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Here we have the thought of the shepherd's rod being his tool, his agency for comforting those who had the privilege of being in Chicago last Sunday and hearing Brother Richard Sirassi's talk on the 23rd Psalm, talks on the 23rd Psalm, parts 1 and 2, really could see the role that the staff had. The various things the staff was used for by the shepherd in the keeping of the sheep in line, in the numbering of the sheep, in the chastisement of the sheep, in the whole training and direction of the sheep. It was his basic tool of operation. And so this is the authority of Christ. When was the authority cast to earth? Well, really, the authority, and when we say the authority of Christ, we're not looking strictly at Jesus. We quoted the 23rd Psalm just now, didn't we? Who holds the staff in the 23rd Psalm? Not Jesus. That psalm starts out, Jehovah is my shepherd, I shall not want. The great shepherd is Jehovah. He is overall, he's using Christ as an under-shepherd for him. So we go back to Genesis to see the casting of the rod to the ground. And I think the verse we want to look at particularly is verse 22. This is after Adam and Eve have taken the forbidden fruit. And the Lord God said, behold, the man is become as one of us, to know good and evil. And now lest he put forth his hand, and take also the tree of life and live forever. Therefore the Lord God sent him forth from the Garden of Eden. Here we have not only the fact that Satan tempted man by saying, if you eat of this tree, you will be as God, to know good and evil. we have God admitting the truth of Satan's temptation. God says, behold, man has become as one of us, to know good and evil. Doesn't say complimenting him, but he says it acknowledging that fact, that he now experientially knows good and evil. Put a sidelight here. This verse sometimes poses a problem. We say that to know good and evil is to know good and evil experientially. To experience good and evil. That man could have become knowledgeable of good and evil by listening, by hearkening to what God said. And God could have said, eat, that's no good. Don't eat, that's good. To eat that tree is evil, not to eat it is good. Now he knows good and evil. I say, well, that isn't what the verse means. The verse means he knows it by experiencing what evil is. But then the problem is, how has he become as one of us to know good and evil? Because God didn't know it by experience. God knew it intuitively. Intuition is his base of knowledge. He did not experience evil to know what evil is. He experienced good, yes. But what Adam was getting into was not something that God or Christ had done. The explanation that appeals to us most may not appeal to all. We present it purely as our opinion of harmonizing this and realizing there are other possible explanations. We think that the setting here, if we take this setting in its fullness, that God is taking of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, and he is making an object lesson for all of his previous creation. Now, man isn't his first creation. Angels were first. And there are millions of them, as far as we know. Probably more than that. Because Jesus had, he called them allegiance to his help alone. And there are angels around us. Life in outer space, there sure is. And this isn't the kind of life they're expecting to find. You know, it's angelic life that he's got of many different planes of being. And we think that, not literally now, but for our minds, for our finite minds, let's view it literally. When Adam and Eve sinned, he said, I want you all come see this. This is what I want you to learn by observation. What they're doing by experience. Now, this isn't that far out. You remember the scripture, we are a spectacle to men and angels. The angels watch what we're doing, which things the angels desire to look into. So he is saying, so now, here, you all come. And that would include Lucifer as well. He said, look what's happened. They have done what I told them not to do. He's become as, he turns to his spectators, as one of us to know good and evil. And whose heart would jump a beat? Lucifer's, because his heart already knew good and evil. He knew it experientially. He was one who knew this, and it was an accusation back here. He was the one who said, you'll become as God, as a God, as a mighty one, like I am, to know good and evil. He knew it by his own experience of already having rebelled, having formulated the thoughts, I will ascend to the sides of the north high, I will be like God. So we think that here is the one, only one in that coast, at that time experientially knew both good and evil. That's sort of a sideline. In any case, man became in the same position. Man took on a certain godlike quality, and godlike I put in parentheses with a big question mark after. He took on a quality of determining his own destiny. That's what I mean when I say godlike quality. And he said, now I will determine what I will do. God up there, Jehovah, says, don't eat, I will eat. And he chooses what he will do in his life. And as a result, he gets into trouble. But he does learn what good and evil is. And God permits this. He casts his authority to the earth. He says, go ahead and do it your way. Now, he could, in his power, easily stop it right there. And said, halt, we'll make another creation, we'll start from scratch, until I find one that will obey. And he probably would only run through a certain number before he gets somebody, you know, in the way he created to obey. But instead, he lets it go on the ground, lets it become a serpent. And it becomes evil. You can sort of see this in a way in contrasting the two visions in the book of Daniel. The chapter 2 and chapter 7. Because what is evil to God often appears good to man. And this is well brought out in that contrast. Remember in Daniel 2, you see all the kingdoms of the world. How? as a beautiful, glorious image, standing there with a head of gold and with its magnificent arms and breast of silver, and then you go down to the brass and the thighs of iron, and beautiful structure. That's how the governments appeared to Earth. And Daniel 7 was how God looked at the same governments. Four beasts upon the earth. And the last one was great and terrible. Too horrible to even describe. So the same thing which is good to man is evil to God, and that's what man needs to learn. But although God permits this to happen, there are scriptures aplenty to show that he does not permit it forever. That he once again will take back his authority, and taking back the authority will again have the rod as a rod in his hand. And I've noted down here in my notes Jeremiah 18:4, and I sort of forgot what it says. I'm going to look at it and sort of share it together. Oh, yes. This is the lesson of the potter, and it illustrates the same point of how he is not distressed when things go wrong because he has full authority and control. Jeremiah 18, 1-4. The word which came to Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, Arise and go down to the potter's house, for there I will cause thee to hear my words. And I went down to the potter's house, and behold, he wrought his work on the wheels. And the vessel that he made of clay was marred in the hand of the potter. So he made it again another vessel, as seemed good to the potter to make it. That's exactly what the Lord did. He was making this vessel of mankind. Satan got in there, a little fly among the clay, and it was marred. He dashes it to pieces, mix it with water, remix the clay into just a lump of clay, remix the vessel. I said, fine. It didn't distress him that it was marred. It was something that could be redeemed and reclaimed and made into, again, a beautiful vessel. And so the serpent, the rod is cast down, it becomes a serpent, he takes it back into his hands. As we continue this discussion now, we want to break our discussion into three sections. First, we want to look at this in a doctrinal manner, as the doctrine of the permission of evil. Second, we want to look at the revelation of this to prove God's authority and Christ's authority in a prophetic manner, the voice of the sign as a prophecy. And third, in a practical manner, in the way we can apply the lessons in our life. In a doctrinal manner, as we view this chaotic condition and throwing it down, and letting man go at his own way, there are only three explanations to a philosophic mind. We're saying a philosophic mind because as we first look at it, we're not looking at it even from Scripture. We're looking at it from a fact. Taken for granted the fact that Adam was created perfect. If that is a fact, take for granted the fact that now we have chaos. That's obvious. That fact allows itself of only three possible explanations. The lesson of Moses' rod helped pinpoint which one is correct. You know it anyway. The first explanation is Satan won. That's the first logical explanation. Contest between God and Satan in the Garden of Eden. Man chose Satan's side, and obviously what he's doing is what Satan wanted. So that's one explanation, possibly philosophical. But it won't fit the lesson. It was Moses' rod. It wasn't the serpent to begin with. Moses' rod became the serpent. It was the authority in Moses' hand. It was that which was in God's hand. The second explanation. God caused it to happen. God made this happen. He wanted evil upon this world, and so he forced evil. But Moses relinquished the rod. It wasn't taken from him. He voluntarily permitted to drop. He picked it up, which we think brings the third explanation, the answer. God permits evil. He permits it to be taken from him because he knows he has the power to go down and to take it again. And this is further bolstered by the very simple statement that on the seventh day, God rested. He let things happen. He let things take their own course. Instead of being involved in doing it his way, he lets it go the way it will go. Because at the end of that day, he's through with his rest. He said, okay, time to get busy. Picks it up, and it again is a full staff in his hand. Is God taking up the rod today? Not really. And no, because in the second sign, which coordinates, these all three signs are the same lesson, they're just different perspectives. The second sign is the one that shows he's not. The hand is still partially leprous. The church is still on this side of the veil. But it's partially clean. We're in the action of the beginning of the withdrawal of the hand. We're in the action where the hand coming out is partially clean, that which has been resurrected, but still partially leprous. So we are in the turning point, in the transition from the serpent-like rod, from the leprous-like hand, to the clean hand, to the retaken rod. And this fits in very well with the statement in Acts 3, 19-21 about the times of restitution coinciding with the beginning of the second presence of Christ. So doctrinally, the lesson of the rod is that God permits evil upon the earth because he has the ability to reclaim evil and bring it back to a position of his full authority. But that which he has relinquished becomes again totally authoritative in his hands. But prophetic. How will it convince? And who will it convince? The first time it was used by Moses to Aaron, convincing him to be a spokesman. Aaron needed no demonstration. He only needed the communication by Moses, telling him all things that God had told him in the mount, telling him what the three signs were, and he was convinced. He was willing to accept that and to become the spokesman in promulgating that to others. And we think this is what happened during the first 3.5 years after the Lord was present, was the communication through study and prayer between him and probably optional wise and faithful servants. Now what we mean by that, we don't feel that the Lord had decided way back there, come along 1874, I'm going to choose Charles Taze Russell to be my servant. We think that when he came, he took Bible students, sincere Bible students, and presented to them truths through the revealment of the scriptures. And then, depending on how they reacted to these truths, he chose one among them for his faithfulness in reacting to be the servant that he would use. This, we think, is the impression of Matthew 24, where he talks about the evil servant. We don't feel that the evil servant points to an individual. We feel that the evil servant, like the wise and faithful servant, are an option. He works with a group of individuals. Charles Taze Russell, Nelson Barber, probably others. I'm just picking two that we're most familiar with. And he gives them all opportunities. How are you going to react to this truth I'm pouring out during this particular period of time? If your reaction to it is an appreciation of the return of my son, an appreciation of the work that's going to be going on, and a grasp of this and a willingness to dedicate your life to communicating it, I can use you for a special job I've got. If your reaction is pride, beating your fellow servant, saying the Lord delays his coming, you're going to have to go out into outer darkness and wait for the wait with mankind. I can't use you right now because I'm looking for particular characteristics. Hindsight being better than foresight, we can look back and appreciate that the one who exhibited these characteristics was Pastor Russell, and that he fits this category. He, to him was communicated these truths, and having received them, he was willing to become the spokesman in passing these on to others. Now, along the same line, I think there's another thing that indicates this. Time prophecy in scriptures is given to us partially to inform, but also to think about. Because sometimes time prophecy comes up with unusual answers. And we just take the answers without thinking, why are they so? It is based upon time prophecy. The Jubilees is an example. The days of Daniel is another example. Based upon time prophecy, we arrive at the conclusion that the Lord returned, Jesus, in 1874. Based upon time prophecies, the time of Revelation 6, the parallel dispensations, the prophetic time of Israel in Romans 11, we arrive at the conclusion that the Lord raised the sleeping saints in 1878. These are two conclusions we accept, I think, by and large. Okay, now think about it more. Why, if he returned in 1874, does he wait 3.5 years to resurrect the sleeping saints? Why is he idle? Or is he idle? What is he doing? What is the purpose of delaying? We say that the resurrection of the sleeping saints is the first executive act. What's the executive doing for 3.5 years before he does an act? You know, why does he take so long before doing something? Both dates are pretty well established, time prophecy-wise, as being true dates. But there must be a reason for the interval. I would think there is. To get to the reason for the interval, we'd like to think about this question. When he raises the sleeping saints, what do they do? We know enough that they don't float around heaven playing harps. We can't quite picture them just sitting back waiting for the rest of the church to be finished for a wedding and sitting in some anteroom someplace. We doubt whether it takes them that long to meet God and all the angels. We think that if it took them that long, it would take us a while too, and you guys still do like things until we meet them all. So that it's not just a sitting around situation. What are they doing? Well, we're told what they're doing. We don't need to guess. We're told in Revelation 14:14, "Blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth. They will rest from their labors, and their works will follow them." Their works will follow those who come after. It doesn't say the works of the sleeping saints would follow them, the works of those who died after this. Well, let's put ourselves in the position of the Apostle Paul. If we were the Apostle Paul, that'd be great. We'd be beyond the veil now. You know, that would be nice. But if we were the Apostle Paul, the moment in 1878 when he was raised, how long to him was he dead? As far as he was concerned, he was dead just like that. As far as he was concerned, it was the moment. Twinkling went on. In fact, it was nearly 2,000 years. But as far as he was concerned, time stops when you're in the grave. Because there is no knowledge, there is no device, there is no wisdom, there is no time in the grave whither thou goest. So as far as he was concerned, he just continued on working. He worked as long as he lived, and he continued on working. And that whole time was just compressed into an instant, as far as he was concerned. We think the emphasis in Revelation 14 is on the pronoun there, T-H-E-I-R. Blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth, for their works follow them. The Apostle Paul continued working as long as he was living, and as soon as he began a life, became alive again. But the work that he was doing when he was raised was different than the work he was doing here. His work didn't follow him. He picked up a new job. When he went from there to here, all of a sudden he went from talking about a coming kingdom to working in a present kingdom. It was that dramatic. You know, it was something which he had been pointing to. Sometime their kingdom is going to come. Sometime Christ is going to return. And the next minute he's working side by side with returned Christ. But for the saints that are on this side of the veil, they have already begun working with the returned Christ. Their work just continues. It is the continuation on the other side of the same work that is being done on this side of the veil. And that's why we think the stress in that verse is on the word their work. And we think this answers what the sleeping saints, now risen, the risen saints are doing. They're doing the same work there that we're doing here, only much better, much more efficiently. They don't bother taking time out to sleep 24 hours a day. I'd like to do that. They don't take time out to sleep 8 hours a day. They don't take time out to eat 3 meals a day. They don't take time out to watch a television show or something else that we may do to waste a little of our time. They're just constantly involved. And what they do perfectly with speed to get from here to Rome in 2 seconds. You know, where even with jet planes, it takes us longer. But they're doing the same work. Otherwise, our works don't follow us. If they're sitting idle, then our works don't follow. It's the same activity that we're doing. So they are raised for a purpose, to assist the Lord in kingdom work. Now, let's come back. Why does the Lord raise them? To help. To assist in kingdom work. It's as simple as that. Why does he wait 3.5 years? Because they are working with us. When they are raised, what kind of minds do they have? Not only brilliant, perfect. Not only perfect human, perfect spiritual. Anything that they need to be taught, they can be taught like that. Instant retention, instant comprehension, instant ability to think it out to its logical conclusions, and instant willingness to do the action. That fast. But take the most faithful of men. He can't do it that fast. It's got to take a while to consider, to revise thinking, to make judgments, to fit into pattern. And so it took 3.5 years to train the wise and faithful servant. If he was to raise the sleeping saints immediately, they'd be ready before the earthly part to be ready. So he first prepares the earthly part for its activity, and then he says, now I'll raise the sleeping saints, I'm ready for them, I got this part sufficiently trained, so you can work together. And that makes a reason for this delay in the 3.5 years. Okay. Moses to Aaron. The training of the wise and faithful servant. By the communication only. Now we come down to the conviction of the church class. The conviction of them of the authority of Christ. And in this case, remember there in the 29th to 31st verse of Exodus 4, in this case he performs the signs. There is more than a communication because we are just a little bit slower. We need a little bit more proof. And so he demonstrates to us, we think, 2 of the signs, not 3. We think that was implied in the fact that he said they believed, therefore they didn't need the third sign. He demonstrates to us first why God permits evil. And especially as you go over the history of the harvest movement, notice the tremendous importance and conviction of those who came out of Babylon by that doctrine. It was one of the primary reaping doctrine. When brethren saw why God permitted evil, they saw the 2 salvations. When they saw that, they began to see that he not only permits it, but he's reversing the trend. They saw his return. These were the doctrines that convinced them that this was the truth, because it tied the whole Bible together. This is the doctrine of the plan. Without the permission of evil, you have no plan. You have isolated incidents that are each true, but there's nothing tying them together. There's no reason why to evil. No reason why to 6,000 years of man's history. But that makes the reason, and it shows God is a loving God and is in control. So that becomes a strong conviction of the authority of God and the authority of Christ. The second thing was the doctrine of the body of the church. An imperfect body, recognizing that we, being imperfect, can be part of his handiwork, can be used by him. Once those 2 things were recognized, that he has enough power, enough authority to use imperfect clay, then we become willing workers in his hand. Without those 2, we are not. This is sufficient to convince. He doesn't need to turn the truth into blood. He doesn't need to make us go through a period of being repulsed by truth. Well, notice he does need it for man. But to the church, these 2 signs are the conviction. I need to move on. Aaron to Pharaoh. This is when the signs are given to Pharaoh. Now notice, here it is not Moses demonstrating the signs to Pharaoh. It is Aaron demonstrating the signs. It isn't Christ demonstrating directly, but he's demonstrating it through his agencies upon the earth. These are the ones that he's using to make the demonstration. In this case, he begins with the first sign. He begins by throwing his rod on the ground and becomes a serpent. Pharaoh calls the magicians and says, can you do the same thing? Well, yeah, we can do it too. They had a trick. You know, there was a certain kind of snake that's in the Sinai. I think it's called the stick snake, if I'm not mistaken. And this snake, when it's touched with a human hand, it becomes paralyzed and becomes just solid as a rod. And they would use this, and they would tie a little thong around it. And this would keep it in this immobilized condition. And so when they would throw it down, they would unwind the thong, and the snake would become a snake. And then they grab it again, they could make it become a stick. And it was a magician trick that was fairly well known at the time. The only difference was Aaron didn't have a trick rod. He still didn't. You know, he had a real rod, and it worked. Well, all of a sudden, he had all these snakes crawling around, and the hungry snake of Aaron went and swallowed everyone up. It took it and took every one of them up, and then he took it up, and the other magicians had no rods left. They were all inside of this rod, and I imagine they were pretty unhappy. They had to go out and get some more trick snakes. But this was how this principle worked there. But how beautifully that works. The first message that came out from the Aaron and the elders class, but the Aaron class, was the message, why does God permit evil? The first public message of the truth movement was the book, Food for Thinking Christians, subtitled, Why Does God Permit Evil? That was the subtitle. When this came out, what's so unusual about that? We've got theories too, why God permits evil. And Christendom had loads of theories. The only problem with their theories was, like Job's comforters, it took half the question, not the other half. And so the true theory gobbled up all the other theories. It encompassed them all, but it showed that they were all partial. And the true theory had the one thing back of a full restitution for all mankind, which the other theories didn't. The other theories let evil run amok, then you get rid of the evil by putting him in hell, he puts a whole new batch here, and this new batch of people are going to serve God great. Well, if that's true, why not start out with a new batch? To accomplish nothing with the intermediate batch. All you did was show that that model didn't work. And you start with a new model. Here was a theory, not a theory, a truth, a doctrine that encompassed all of that into one solid truth. But man has not been convinced. That's rather obvious. The size of our group here today proves it. It has not been a concept that has held conviction to mankind at large. He doesn't show to man the doctrine of the leper's hand because he doesn't offer to man the privilege of being part of the leper's hand. That is not open to them. So that second sign is not given to Pharaoh. He hasn't got part in that leper's hand. That was only shown to the elders of Israel because only the church has the privilege of being part of the leper's hand. He said, you won't accept my truth. We'll start with some plagues. And he begins plaguing them. In Exodus 10, in Revelation 7. But after the message of truth is thoroughly rejected, and that'll be when the last member of the church is gone, then we think that the final onslaught, although we think the plagues are already in process, we should, in our own thinking, we believe we're into the plagues. But as the truth is rejected, it is followed by the truth becoming repulsive. Remember, that was the second plague, the water in Revelation, the plague upon the sea, turning into the blood of a dead man. And the third, the rivers and fountains of water turning into blood. And we want to mention one thing. One thing is true through all the plagues of Revelation. And it's this basic thing that's in this third sign. And that is, truth becomes repulsive. And we'd like to go just briefly to the seventh plague in Revelation to prove this. You know, the seventh plague is the final plague. And the seventh plague is a very involved plague. It's quite a study within itself. We're only touching one aspect. There's about eight or nine aspects to the seventh plague, eight or nine separate things that happen. We want to take verse 21, Revelation 16, 21, and notice the last feature of the last plague. And there fell upon men a great hail out of heaven, every stone about the weight of a talent. And men blasphemed God because of the plague of this hail, for the plague thereof was exceeding great. Now what we want to notice here is the hail forms such a separate and distinct part of the seventh plague that is almost out of plague by itself. Now it says the plague thereof of the hail was great. Hail, we believe, is truth. Hard, cutting truth. But notice the reaction. This is the point. What do people say when this hard, cutting truth comes? Do they say, thank you, Lord, for the truth? They say, excuse me, I won't say it, because they start swearing. And they say, I don't want any part of it. I don't want it. They blaspheme God because of the hail. It's something that they don't want. It's something that they are mad about. They're very upset with this hail. It is not truth that they desire. It's a truth they don't desire.
What is the plague of the hail? We'd like to suggest what that hard-cutting truth is. Reviewing just briefly in your minds, from the time of the Lord's return onward, there has been one kind of truth that has reached mankind. And this truth is basically encompassed in the term the Jubilee Trumpet. It has been the truth of the oppression of man against man. The truth of the oppression of centuries of mankind by each other. And the reaction to this truth has been the Jubilee Trumpet. It has been claiming the rights. It has been the rights of the individual. This is probably the strongest proclaimed truth of the Second Advent of Christ. And the rights of the individual means civil rights. It means women to live. It means equality of nations, equality of sexes. It means equality in every plane. And this equality thing is really snowballing. You can hear it constantly, louder and louder. Right now it's screaming in our ears. Every place you go, there's equality, equality proclaimed. Finally, equality is proclaimed so much you come to anarchy. Every man for himself. This is my place. I got the right to do my own thing. You do what you want. That's total anarchy. Anarchy is the result of full equality. Each one saying, no one's going to dictate to me. Then you come to Jacob's trouble. The ancient worthies are on the scene. And they said, we got the truth for the world. What is that truth? All rights suspended. There's a dictator on the earth. His name is Jesus. You will do what he says, and if you don't, you're going to be paralyzed. Total enforcement of a dictator's rights. No more liberties for the individual. And they're going to say, that's not what we expected. This isn't what the trend has been. It's been building up to just the opposite. We think that's the plague of the hail. That's the hard-cutting truth. And it's repulsive, even as the first truths are repulsive, until they realize what kind of dictator. Until they realize that this is an educational process to bring them into appreciating how to use rights. Because when they use their rights without education, they had anarchy. At the end of the kingdom, I said, now, you're on your own. Everybody's equal. The valleys are leveled. High places are made low. The low places are made high. Now you go ahead and try your rights. And then they will try them with the principle of love for each other, and it's going to work beautifully. But in the interim, he steps down. He suspends those rights. And so I think this is part of this plague system that is shown in little brief in this first plague. Now our time ran out before we got to the practical. We're going to mention some of the points in the practical. We're not going to elaborate. The lesson, we think, for you and I in the first sign is that true power can relinquish authority. I think that's the whole lesson, practically, of the first plague. True power can relinquish authority. God could permit evil to happen. This is astounding, because anybody who has to be in charge of other people, whether he's a clerk in an office over two or three others, whether he's the manager of a big company, the one thing they all want to do is maintain tight control. But here is God, who's in charge of billions of people, having so much power he can let them go their own way, because he knows how to bring order out of chaos. Probably the best example scripturally of a non-Christian doing this was the expression of Gamaliel. Remember Gamaliel, one of the Sanhedrin, when the apostles were arrested and they wanted to persecute them because they were disobeying Mosaic law? He said, let them go. If it's of God, you can't stop it. If it's not of God, it won't prosper. He had that feeling of security in his office, that he was willing to let the Christians, heretics though they were, run their course. And that's basically what it amounts to. And so the lessons for us, lesson as a parent, over-controlling a child, creating what? Frustration. The lesson of an ecclesia, over-controlling its members, and saying, you shall do only what we do. The antidote, freedom in Christ. The lesson can be doctrinal, over-control, where we want to make sure everybody believes exactly what we believe. And there we think of the antidote as being Brother Russell's statement where he quotes Voltaire, I disagree with what you have to say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. Organizational over-control, or the charge is subversion if it's not done my way. The lesson is that no group is any stronger than its permission of an active voice of dissent. And that this is the lesson of permitting this to happen, because the full control, the final control, is in the hand of the one who dropped the rod, of God. The moral is, let go and let God. It covers the entire situation, we think, of the lesson of Moses' rod.